Today is Tuesday, February 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the total number of cases of the COVID-19 tops 72,000 with nearly 2,000 deaths.
At the moment, we don't have enough data on cases outside China to make a meaningful comparison on the severity of disease or the case fatality rate.
Plus, Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has vowed to defeat the opposition and retake all areas still under rebel control, and the Boy Scouts of America file for bankruptcy. Those stories and more are all next. The Federal Judges Association, an independent group of U.S. federal judges, has announced an emergency meeting to address issues related to the Justice Department's decision to revise the sentencing recommendation for Roger Stone, a longtime ally of U.S. President Donald Trump. After the intervention, all four prosecutors in the case resigned, and one quit the agency altogether. Now, speaking to USA Today, Philadelphia U.S. District Judge Cynthia Roof said the meeting could not wait until a regularly scheduled one in the spring. Joining us on the phone is Professor James Sample from Hofstra University. James, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve.
So I wanted to get your take. We have the FJA calling for an earlier meeting and 2,000-plus prosecutors calling for AG Barr's removal. What should we make out of this?
Well, this is a break the glass moment for the rule of law and for democracy. I think it is an overstatement to say that the Department of Justice is expected to be entirely independent of the White House. It is not entirely independent. However, there is a history dating back at least to the post-Watergate era in which cultural norms and practices have informed the relationship between the White House, the Attorney General, and the Department of Justice, and particularly, and then there's a separate matter of the federal judiciary, and in all of those instances, we're seeing those norms be trampled to a degree that the United States has never really seen domestically.
If we take a look at what happened with the DOJ recommending a different kind of sentencing in the Roger Stone case, has that happened in the past? Because you mentioned that, you know, the DOJ should be independent, but not necessarily always has been.
Sure. There are times when the president or political leadership weighs in on points of emphasis or matters of policy, and even sometimes on individual prosecutions. But as the 2,000 or so ex-Department of Justice attorneys indicated the other day in a letter, it is unheard of for the department's top leaders to overrule their line prosecutors who are following established practices within the department to give preferential treatment to a close associate and close friend of the President of the United States. This is unprecedented.
So ideally, how independent should the DOJ be? Because one of the arguments is from the Republicans and other supporters of the president is that the DOJ is part of the executive branch and the president is the chief executive.
It's a very good question, but I would turn it around and say that this is not a matter, and it's one of the few matters in this day and age that is not really a matter of Republican versus Democrat. In fact, traditional conservatives, traditional Republicans who are concerned about the scope of government and the scope of unchecked governmental power have every reason to be concerned here. This is a question not of Republican versus Democrat. It's a question of democracy versus dictatorship.
Thank you very much for your insight. James Sample is a professor at Hofstra University. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Steve.
Chinese health officials reported on Tuesday that the number of confirmed cases from a coronavirus outbreak has surpassed 72,000, with the death toll rising to nearly 1,900. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus provided this update on cases outside of mainland China.
Outside China, there are now 804 cases in 24 countries with 3 deaths. In the past 24 hours, there have been 110 new cases outside China, including 99 on the Diamond Princess cruise ship. We have now had cases of COVID-19 outside China for more than a month. We're supporting national authorities in every country that has cases to track the virus and understand how people were infected. So far, there are 92 cases in 12 countries outside China of human-to-human transmission. At the moment, we don't have enough data on cases outside China to make a meaningful comparison on the severity of disease or the case fatality rate. We're following up with countries to get more information about what happens about each case and the outcome.
Now, experts around the globe worry that the virus quarantine measures may not be as effective as previously hoped. The AP's Charles de Ledesma has that part of the story.
Thousands of passengers and crew are set to disembark over the next several days in the port of Yokohama near Tokyo following a mass two-week quarantine. But since the tough measure was implemented, more than 540 cases of the virus have been identified among the more than 3,700 people isolated. Scientists say it's clear the quarantine did not work fully and that a probe is needed to determine why it failed and if there's another mode of transmission aboard the Diamond Princess cruise liner. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Now, speaking of the Diamond Princess, Australia is preparing to evacuate more than 200 of its citizens from the coronavirus-hit cruise vessel. They will face 2 weeks of isolation in their return home. Phil Mercer reports also that the first group of Australian coronavirus evacuees from Wuhan in China has been released from quarantine.
The Diamond Princess has been in quarantine since February 3. On board the cruise liner have been about 3,700 passengers and crew, including dozens of Australian tourists. It is the largest cluster of infections outside China, where the virus was first reported. Australian passengers must decide Tuesday if they'll take up their government's offer of an evacuation flight out of Japan. Authorities in Canberra are planning to fly them home on Wednesday. They will all go into isolation for 14 days, in addition to the time they've already spent confined on the Diamond Princess. In a recorded message to passengers, Australia's Chief Medical Officer Brendan Murphy said such precautions were essential.
There is evidence of ongoing further infections in the ship, in the crew, and in some passengers. Even though we think some of you probably have been well quarantined, there is uncertainty about whether some of you may be incubating the virus, and if you came back into the Australian community, you may expose your family or other members of the community to this infection.
Two planes carrying hundreds of US citizens from the cruise ship in Japan have arrived back home and will face 14 days in isolation. However, some American travellers have refused to be evacuated, preferring to wait until the ship's official quarantine comes to an end on February 19. The first group of Australian coronavirus evacuees from the coronavirus epicentre at Wuhan, China, has been released from quarantine Monday from Christmas Island in the Indian Ocean. More than 200 Australians were flown home, while other evacuees remain in isolation at a former miners' camp near the city of Darwin. There are currently 15 cases of the disease in Australia. Health officials say 8 patients are reported to have recovered, while the other 7 are in a stable condition. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Now turning to business, the coronavirus has affected both sales and production for Apple, with the company signaling it will not meet revenue guidance for March. The outbreak has put South Korea's economy into, quote, emergency situations, and Japan is on the brink of recession. Companies are warning their bottom lines will take a hit, and governments are ramping up stimulus measures for economies that just weeks ago were hoping to see recoveries after months of uncertainty due to trade tensions and slowing global growth. Many in the region were hoping that an easing of trade tensions, thanks to a truce between the United States and China and their tariff war, would help revive sluggish trade this year. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has vowed to defeat opposition and retake the area still under rebel control. Assad addressed the nation Monday as his army made gains against rebel forces and jihadists in the Aleppo and Idlib provinces in the northwest. VOA's Ladisa Hoke reports the Syrian army also seems ready to clash with Turkey military forces supporting rebels in the region.
Fierce fighting was reported in Idlib on Sunday after Syrian government forces took control of the M5 highway, which connects the capital Damascus in the south with Aleppo in the north. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad declared victory in Aleppo on Monday.
Aleppo has won and Syria has won. We have all won over the fear that they tried to grow in our hearts. We won over the delusions that they tried to stitch in our minds. We won over the separation, the hatred, betrayal, and all those who represent these qualities and carry them and practice them.
Assad acknowledged that the fighting is not over, with Turkish forces in Idlib supporting anti-government rebels. His army has not spared civilians or refugees in the area.
We have been displaced nearly 20 times since the beginning of the war. We came to this camp 2 years ago believing that this area will be safe, without bombings or danger. Yesterday, the shells started falling here. A person was killed and there are several casualties. And today the camps are all displaced and we don't know where to go.
Turkey is hosting more than 3 million Syrian refugees and says it cannot take any more. Turkish diplomats began talks with their Russian counterparts in Moscow on Monday in the hope of stopping the Syrian government offensive backed by Russia.
I have told Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov that the aggression in Idlib must stop, that a lasting ceasefire, which is not going to be breached, has to be achieved now.
There is little hope that Assad will stop the offensive as long as he enjoys the support of Russian Air Force and Iranian militias.
The battle to liberate the Idlib and Aleppo countryside is ongoing, regardless of some of the empty bubbles of sound coming from the north, as well as the battle for liberating all Syrian soil, crushing terrorism, and achieving stability.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has amassed troops on the border with Syria and threatens military action if the Syrian troops don't withdraw. Russia has blamed the fighting on Turkey, saying Ankara has violated the 2019 Sochi Agreement, allowing Turkey to remove Kurdish militias from northern Syria in exchange for the Syrian government's delaying its military offensive. Turkey blames Syria for renewed fighting. Idlib is the last major rebel stronghold in Syria, and Assad is determined to get it back under the government control. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch is in northern Syria, visiting prisons holding suspected members of the Islamic State militants. I spoke to her earlier about the challenges they're facing.
This area is extremely volatile and a great example of how volatile it is now and how much worse it could be. We visited one in northeastern Syria where 5,000 men are crowded into what was long ago a schoolhouse, and now it's a prison, and they have, you know, 80 to over 100 men in individual rooms. And they've been there for more than a year. Many are injured, many have died, and there have been no trials, and this is the main issue. They haven't been accused officially of anything, investigated, or tried or sentenced, and it doesn't look like it's happening anytime soon. Meanwhile, there are fewer and fewer guards guarding these prisoners. And keep in mind, these men are among the last standing with the Islamic State militant group, so one can assume that they are some of the most hardcore fighters and hardcore extremists. But we don't know that exactly because they haven't actually been charged or investigated. And they are increasingly guarded with fewer soldiers were guarding them. A lot of them have moved to the front lines as northeastern Syria continues to have a standoff with Turkey. They're not in full war anymore as they were in October briefly, but there are still front lines and there are still bombs. Also, the ISIS camps, the camps of the families, the wives and children of the fighters that are in jail or killed or escaped somehow, those are essentially prisons as well. And just today we came from one of those and we talked to this child, and he's 13 years old, and he tells us that not only does he want to grow up to be a fighter, he said 99% of the kids in the camp want to, Meanwhile, the refugee crisis is growing daily from the fight in Idlib, further destabilizes the situation.
If we take a look at the fighting that has been taking place, not only last year when the offensive from Turkey began, you know, there was great concern for humanitarian crisis. And as you mentioned, you know, there's the risk of more violence coming on. Based on what you're seeing and who you're talking to, how are people still reacting to that kind of situation there?
Well, a lot of people are running out of the fighting in Idlib province and Idlib city, and they're coming east towards this area. And there are lots of refugee camps, and there is a network of humanitarian actors in the area. But this area is completely swamped. There's almost no resources left to accept more people. And they will. I mean, there's no option. There's no border, and they're not going to turn people down. But there's no resources and not enough food for the people who are already here.
That was VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch speaking to me from northern Syria. Now, coming up later in the program, the Boy Scouts of America make an announcement.
The Scouts could be forced to sell off some of their vast property holdings, including campgrounds and hiking trails, to raise money for a victim compensation trust fund.
And you're listening to VOA News.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. International parties are welcoming news that Yemen's government, backed by a Saudi-led military coalition and Iranian-allied Houthi rebels, have reached a deal on the first large prisoner exchange since the start of the five-year conflict. The agreement has taken place about a week ago of negotiations in the Jordanian capital of Amman. Citing its neutrality, the International Committee of the Red Cross says it has facilitated the agreement, but it cannot disclose the number of prisoners that will be released or the timing involved. Del Gavlak has that story.
The United Nations mission in Yemen announced that the warring sides agreed to immediately begin exchanging lists for the upcoming release of prisoners, calling it the first official large-scale exchange of its kind since the beginning of the long-running conflict in Yemen. The parties showed us that even with the growing challenges on the ground, the confidence they have been building can still yield positive results, said Martin Griffiths, UN Special Envoy for Yemen. The breakthrough came despite continued heavy fighting over the weekend, including the shooting down of a Saudi helicopter by Houthi rebels and retaliatory air raids by the Saudi-led military coalition that killed about 30 civilians. Prisoner swaps were meant to take place earlier following the December 2018 Stockholm Agreement, but the tentative peace plan stumbled amid ongoing military offenses and a deep-seated distrust between the two sides. Still, Farid Al-Hamed, spokesman for the International Committee of the Red Cross Yemen, called this deal a great step forward. Speaking to VOA from the capital Sana'a, Al-Hamed says, however, the ICRC already engaged both sides to carry out prisoner exchanges involving more than 485 people outside the Stockholm Agreement.
Between the period April 2019 and February 2020, there were several release operations by the parties outside of the Stockholm Agreement. We facilitated those operations. We are happy that though the conduct of hostilities is still ongoing in Yemen, but parties are trying to put more emphasis on the humanitarian needs through these releases.
Al-Hamed says the ICRC and the United Nations hope the warring sides will honor the commitment they just made, because if it succeeds, it could perhaps herald the start to the end of the conflict, which has witnessed thousands of people killed.
It will just pave the way for further releases, which will lead to a peace process, which inshallah will end the conflict. The only way to have this suffering of Yemen reach an end is peace. Other than peace, we will just continue going through this horrible situation.
The number of casualties from Yemen's devastating conflict are staggering. The United Nations has verified at least 7,500 civilians have died by last September. But other monitors, such as the U.S.-based Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, have registered more than 100,000 deaths, including those of 12,000 civilians killed in direct attacks. Analysts say thousands more Yemeni civilians have died from disease, malnutrition, and poor health due to hospital bombings and a lack of medicines. Dale Gaflack for VOA News, Amman.
Sudan's information minister said Monday it could send former leader Omar al-Bashir and other suspects to The Hague for a trial before the International Criminal Court, but any decision would need approval from both military and civilian rulers. Sudanese authorities said last week that they had agreed for Bashir and three other suspects to appear before the ICC without giving details of how that could happen. Sudan's offer to cooperate with the ICC marks an important step in rebuilding relations with the international community after three decades during which the country was isolated and sanctioned for its links with Islamist militants and the violence in Darfur. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Al-Khamenei tweeted that the high turnout in the parliamentary election will display unity in Iran against its so-called enemies. The message comes days before the February 21st election. The Guardian Council, a hardline vetting body, has rejected around 6,850 moderate or conservative hopefuls in favor of hardliners from among 14,000 applicants. About one-third of lawmakers have also been barred from standing in the election. State news reported Turkish prosecutors investigating the military and justice ministry ordered the arrest of 228 people over suspected links to a network that Ankara says was behind a 2016 coup attempt. There have been a sustained crackdown on alleged followers of U.S.-based Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen since the failed push in July 2016, in which some 250 people were killed. Police still routinely carry out raids targeting suspects. Since the attempted coup, around 80,000 people have been jailed pending trial, and some 150,000 civil servants, military personnel, and others have been fired or suspended from their jobs. Iran sentenced eight environmental activists, including Iranians who reportedly have also British and American citizenship, to prison sentences ranging from 4 to 10 years on charges of spying for the United States and acting against Iran's national security. VOA's Jason Patinkin reports the judiciary spokesman said the appeals court issued the final verdicts.
Two of the activists, Morad Tabaz and Niloufar Bayani, were sentenced to 10 years and were ordered to return the money they allegedly received from the U.S. government for their services. Tabaz is an Iranian who also holds U.S. and British citizenship. Iran does not recognize dual or multiple nationalities, meaning Iranians it detains cannot receive consular assistance from their other countries. In most cases, dual nationals have faced secret charges in closed-door hearings before Iran's Revolutionary Court, which handles cases involving alleged attempts to overthrow the government. Earlier this month, Iran's Supreme Court confirms the death penalty for Amir Rahimpour, who was convicted of spying for the CIA. Iranian state media have alleged that he had shared details of the Islamic Republic's nuclear program with the American spy agency. Jason Patinkin, VOA News.
The Boy Scouts of America filed for bankruptcy after a barrage of sex abuse lawsuits threatened to wipe them out. AP correspondent Julie Walker has that story.
The Scouts are being sued by several thousand men who say they were molested decades ago but are only now eligible to sue because of changes in statute of limitations laws. Bankruptcy puts those lawsuits on hold for now, but the Scouts could be forced to sell off some of their vast property holdings, including campgrounds and hiking trails, to raise money for a victim compensation trust fund that could surpass $1 billion. The bankruptcy petition listed the Boy Scouts' assets as between $1 billion and $10 billion. I'm Julie Walker.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition. on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and engineer, Rob McLean, thank you very much for joining us. Be sure to visit our website, voanews.com, for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.